Suffering voice, black suffering voice, black suffering voice, black suffering voice, black. Sovereignty never ceded. Welcome to the Black Block. Free CR. Broadcasting from Wurundjeri country. Sovereign voice. Black Block. Free CR.
Good morning, 3CR. This is the Black Block. My name's Viv, and I'm joined by Mariki Onus. Good morning, Mariki.
Good morning, Viv. How are you?
I rocked up a bit late. I've still got to catch my breath, but I'm glad to be here. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, it's really good to be here.
It's amazing having two people in the studio and getting back to some normality here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited about today.
So,
as you know,
let's tell listeners what's coming up.
So thankfully, Viv invited me to do co-hosting for today, and we pulled together two special guests, Senator Thorpe, that is, and activist, lawyer and author Michael Mansell from the Palawa people. So we'll hear from those two special guests later on in the program.
In the meantime, what else is happening? I have not been... I'm not in the loop, Mariki. Can you fill me in? What's going on?
Well, I'm not entirely in the loop myself, but I thought it'd be really important for us to acknowledge and mention that Nathan Reynolds' inquest, his coronial inquest, starts today, and it's an 8-day inquest, and it begins at the Lindcombe Coroner's Court. He was a 36-year-old Dungari man who died in custody in New South Wales in 2018. Support the family by following updates and sharing support on the hashtag Justice for Nathan Reynolds. So we'll be listening closely, but it's really important for the community to keep our eyes on how the colonial courts carry out this case. And I reckon that does change how they deliver the case when there's huge public scrutiny on how they behave and how they act. Very seldom is there ever justice in a coroner's court, but I think it's important for everyone to show support to the family.
Absolutely. Look, I might play a song and we're going to come back and talk some more.
Yep.
Cool.
Like an acrobat, flipping the key in a better made to be fat with a full contact on a refresh track. Better materialize in a matter when younger your stamina out of my scrap. Every benefit began about the ladder. What's better than the hook of the dream sandman? Horn in my back was a for the jam. Put the mic in my hand, I've been in the land. People like you, who that be? Trembling MC 3173, the hangin' a dandy. New school style, also weapon me. An instrument, any key, multiple ability. Picture that lock, I'm killing it, Kelly. Still a keeping us a rocket and more quick on the draw. I believe I leave the people in awe. I'm letting up the breed to re-maximize it. When I rip it up, cause I be better stay. Here it's all affair, laissez-faire. Release all the time, the hand in the air. Liberation bounds, liberation with the crown. If they don't come around, revolution on the ground. Never want to know that the system's stale. So a new direction when the government's failed. Nevertheless, we embody the flesh. When I'm on the mic, we're like we possess. Surely it's just ain't coming to be the best. This is the streets when we kill in the stress.
Whoa, Warumpi Band.
Tiokasi Chatanzi Wiki Paha Michaje. I'm from the Lakota Nation in the geographical center of North America that we call Turtle Island. And community radio is about your community, your heart, which 3CR Community Radio is right here at 85.5 AM. So it is digital, and I'm presuming you can go worldwide with it. People are listening in America to you, so talk back, Australia, to the earth. Peace with earth. Thank you. Teokas and Ghost Horse, Community Radio is your love.
Community Radio 3CR, indeed. This is Black Block, and as promised, we have a Gunai Gunjut Mara woman, Lydia Thorpe, whose history is steeped in these parts of Fitzroy and Collingwood. She's the first grandchild born into a family of black power activists and women who themselves have changed the course of black Melbourne's history. Lydia had her first job with our uncle, Robbie Thorpe, you just heard there, on Gertrude Street, Fitzroy. Lydia was also the first Aboriginal woman in Victoria State Parliament as the former Greens MP for the seat of Northcote. And earlier this month, you listeners would know that Lydia walked into Parliament House, stood and raised her fist in a black power salute before being sworn in as the first Aboriginal senator for Victoria. And Senator Thorpe carried a stick with 441 notches, each mark representing every Aboriginal death in custody since 1991 during the ceremony. I'd like to welcome Lydia, Senator Thorpe, to the show this morning. Thanks for your time, Lydia. How are you going?
Yeah, good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Lydia. How are you going?
Good, thanks, Mariki. Deadly program, three strong black women.
Can I just ask really quickly, what would you prefer, Senator Thorpe, Lydia? What's the protocol? Lydia. All
Lydia,
right.
Thanks.
Deadly.
So what's it been like? What's been a senator like?
Yeah, tell us about your first couple of weeks in Parliament, Lyd.
Yeah.
Dear.
Well, okay, sure. So it's been in stage four lockdown, like everybody else in metropolitan Melbourne. So a lot of my early starts on my first Senate inquiry was actually the Aboriginal flag inquiry. And it's very rare to walk into a Senate position and basically a few days later get straight into a Senate inquiry. And it reminded me back when I first started in the Victorian Parliament and I was straight in on the treaty legislation, negotiating the treaty debate. Walking into federal parliament, going straight into the Aboriginal flag. I think the higher powers kind of put me in those places at the right time for some reason. So that was an interesting process. It's interesting in that a lot of these committees, a lot of the Senate inquiries, they have majority of the government around the table. So even if you wanted to put up a recommendation, the government senators can outvote you and not allow for those recommendations to come through. So you put through what we call like a dissenting report or just extra comments about recommendations that don't get to be the official position of that committee. So that was an interesting process. It was good to see grassroots mob participate in that inquiry and hear from, you know, people on the ground what they thought about the flag. So that was prior to me actually going to Canberra. I had to do 14-day quarantine in a hotel in Canberra to actually, you know, physically be to go into that chamber, but to be welcomed by traditional owners, Ngambri and Ngunnawal mob was just incredibly important for me as a black woman and following, you know, proper protocol. So that was just incredible down at the embassy. It started to rain, which was actually nice to have a bit of rain on us. I was a bit worried at first about the hair and the shoes and the makeup, but aunt, you know, soon put me in my place, threw the umbrella to the side and said, no, my love, you've got to feel that rain. And I tell you what, when I did, it was just incredible. So that gave me the, you know, the courage to then walk into that place and give a salute and let that chamber know that I'm bringing in grassroots voices here and a struggle you know, an age-old, 240-year-old struggle into a place that denied our voices and our place in that place for far too long. So it's been good. There's more to come. I've got a Senate got estimates on this week and next week, so we get to really grill the government and all the bureaucrats on where they spend their money. So I'm looking forward to asking that. And my first question tonight is at 9 p.m. I'm on from 9 p.m. till 11 p.m. for Senate estimates. So it's exciting.
Sounds really exciting. I just want to go back though. You said that you made a salute, and I saw the video and the photo, and you took a message stick in. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, the importance of making that mark and walking into, what is it called? Is it the Senate chambers?
Yes.
And making that mark, can you talk about the significance of carrying that message stick into Parliament and how that would set your intention in your time there?
Yeah, well, look, we, you know, the constant death in custody of our people is affecting so many of our mob around the country, and including me personally. You know, no one is not affected by someone being lost to the hands of this racist system. And we're running campaigns and we're having Black Lives Matter rallies, which is great, and we need to keep the pressure on. But I wanted to go in there with that voice and with that struggle to highlight to the Senate, but also to the media, that each of those markings on that stick represents a life taken by the system that they all endorse, that continually oppresses our people and ultimately kills us. So the message stick was smoked down at the Aboriginal Tent Embassy first, and yeah, it's just a symbol, I suppose, of how many people we've lost, but also how much work we have to do to turn that around and change these racist policies and legislation and decision-making that goes on in that place. I also wore my possum skin cloak, which I was given in my time at Northcote by people in the Bendigo local Aboriginal community, who gave that possum skin cloak to me for protection. So I felt that I had, you know, I was being protected by my elders, my old people, by going into that place and doing what I had to do, and that was swear allegiance to the coloniser. So I felt I still had that protection by wearing my possum skin. So I was, yeah, it was a rash decision to put my fist up. I only thought about it the night before, freaked out my staff. They were a bit worried when they got a text the next morning saying, I'm going to put my fist up. Good morning, everybody. And that sent everyone into a bit of a tiz. But I felt that it was important to not just walk in there, but to send a strong message from our people.
And that was sent, and I hope, yeah, received. I wanted to ask, have you had any, I know it's early days, but have you had anything that surprised you about your role so far that you didn't expect?
There's a lot of privilege. There's a lot of, yes, Senator, no, Senator, open the door for you, Senator. And that's only, you know, in my world, that's only reserved for our elders. So that's a bit weird and a bit gammon. And I just don't feel comfortable with that. I've asked a number of people just to call me Lydia, but it's the Senate rules, it's the parliamentary rules that they do that. And there's a young Aboriginal woman, in fact, I think it was day two that I walked into Parliament, and she said, hey sis, and I'm like, what? And it was this black woman staffer of Parliament, and I said, just call me Lydia. She said, no, I'm not allowed. And I said, oh, we'll do a secret wave, blackfella wave then every time I come in.
Oh, that's deadly.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's different. We've got a lot of power, which, you know, let's use it. I want this is my people's power. It's not mine personally. and I want my people to know that. So, yeah, otherwise, I mean, it's also, you know, just a job for me, and it's a job that I'm taking very seriously, and it's a job where I'll continue to fight for our people's rights and the betterment of our people.
Lydia, I have a question. Well, not a question, I just want you to make comment. What do you say to people like Jeff Kennett? He tweeted you to say that you basically have to learn to walk before you run in the Senate, and you seem to get a lot of criticism like you're a newbie or you're an understudy, which I feel like has a bit of misogynist and racist tones, as though you're a child. What do you say to criticisms like that from conservatives and other to say that you hardly know what you're doing? When, you know, what do you say to that? What's your response to criticisms like that?
Well, I actually text Jeff and said, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the advice, mate. and he texted me back and said, no worries, Lydia, I'm here for you. Anytime you need any advice, please reach out. So, look, I take on constructive criticism. I'm not about to crawl before I walk in that place. They've been crawling and walking and running and, you know, taking control of our country for far too long. So they're the ones that have got the catching up to do, not us.
Do you really take advice from Jeff Kennett?
No, I don't take advice.
You're being polite.
It's always good to know what the other side are thinking and doing, which I think is very important part of this process, because we need, you know, we're 3% of the population. We need to get the rest of the population over to the way we're thinking and what we want. And it means knowing who your enemy is, knowing who your opposition is. So, you know, I've had some good yarns already in Parliament. I've had yarns with Josh Frydenberg. I've had yarns with the National Party leader in the Senate, Bridget McKenzie, who's well known for sports rot. I had Pauline Hanson sitting next to me in the chamber at one point, which I haven't said out in the media, but I'll let you fellas know. And, you know, I quickly rushed to my seat so I could sit next to her, and she had her back kind of turned to me, and I turned around and I said, hi, Pauline, how are you going today? And she had to turn around and had to say hello to me and also congratulated me for becoming a senator. And that was it. So, you know, I'm in that place.
Interesting.
They're very interesting, and I want to be able to have conversations with all of them because they need to hear the truth, and they need to have some kind of understanding, maybe, if they're open to it.
You might be the one that turns Pauline on her head then.
Amazing. Lydia, where do you get, you know, what I really admire about you is that, you know, the way that your response to the people that you're going to have to deal with every day, this is a tough gig. How do you maintain, you know, your composure? One, I'd last a couple of seconds, me. It's a tough gig, and you respond really dignified. And you know, where does that come from?
I suppose it comes from, like, Mum's very you know, conciliatory in her approach. She always has been. Well, she sat on the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation 20 years ago. And I suppose just meeting people where they're at. So, the conservatives, even the racists, meeting them where they're at and just trying to find some common ground just to start having a yarn with them about. And I don't know, I just treat people like people. And a lot of people in that space don't do that. You know, they're so very white, so very privileged. And they're really out of touch with grassroots people on the ground. So it's a bit of a reality check for them, I suppose. And everyone's actually very, they're very pleasant to one another outside of the chamber. Everyone's, you know, quite friendly. It's different to my experience in the lower house in Victoria, people were badly behaved, screaming at one another. Kids in school groups would be crying from the horror show that would be unfolding in the lower house, so where the Premier sits. And the Senate's a little bit calmer, I would say. People still have shots at one another, but I think that it's just a different vibe. So, yeah.
So the other Aboriginal senators currently, it's got Jackie Lambie's on the list here, Patrick Dodson and Malandiri McCarthy. And then Linda Burney in the House and Ken Wyatt in the House.
In the lower house?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yep. Is there room to, like, hang out, meet, discuss with, you know, your countrymen and women there in any context?
They used to have an Aboriginal caucus there.
Yeah, right.
But they don't have that anymore. Is there an appetite to get that going again, Lydia?
Yes, there is. And I certainly have the appetite for that. So I've already started conversations on when we can have our first meeting together. But, I mean, COVID makes it more difficult. You've still got to follow all of those rules in the parliament. But I've had meetings with Ken and his office already, and I've had meetings with Malandiri and Pat. So, yeah, there's certainly that collaboration, and, you know, we talk about what we're going to support and what we're not going to support and try and get each other over the line and agree to disagree, but it's still very respectful, which is always good because, after all, it's, you know, it's still a workplace at the end of the day.
Yeah. I just want to ask you, just before, we're going to ask you a few questions about the Statement from the Heart and Treaty, because there's been a bit of ruckus on social media and in the media about it, especially since you've come on board and really clearly stated your intention in the media around it. When is your first speech, and what can we expect from that?
Well, COVID has delayed a lot of things, including my first speech. So it will potentially be in November. I am trying to wait for COVID to settle so that at least my mum can be in the chamber. But if that's just not possible, then it'll probably be either early November or mid-November. And what can you expect? Well, whatever I'm about to say is not going to be any shock to grassroots blackfellas in this country. It'll be a shock to the Conservatives. It'll be a shock to other sectors of our community. But grassroots blackfellas, you know, asylum seekers, women who are experiencing violence, they won't be shocked with what I've got to say.
Interesting. Oh, I think I wanted to ask you, a little bit about growing up in Collingwood, because 3CR is in Fitzroy, Collingwood, and a lot of the listeners and community radio supporters and presenters are all from this area, and you're from Collingwood, and I know that you've said that a lot in your media and your campaigning. Can you tell us what it's like walking into a room where those kind of people make decisions about public housing tenants and not usually public housing tenants making decisions for themselves? As someone that grew up in public housing, can you tell us what it's like coming from, you know, Collingwood, the community, and going into spaces like that?
Yeah, well, a lot of these people, as I said earlier, they're so out of touch, you know, and people who live in public housing are considered, you know, they've got this stereotype towards people in public housing, and that is that we're drunk or on drugs or criminals or, you know, some negative idea on people who live in public housing. But I think, you know, having a senator coming from public housing and telling it how it is and how it's a community, it's a safe place, it certainly was it enabled me to get a job. It enabled me to have a safe place for my son. So, you know, it gave me just that chance in life that I wouldn't have otherwise had And, you know, our people still out there, the public housing crisis is out of control right now, but everyone deserves a right to a home or a roof over their head, and our people are struggling to get those basic rights. So public housing is incredibly important, and it needs to stay in public hands. As soon as it gets privatised, then, you know, we've got no controls over what happens or how much people pay. But my time in the flat, 253 Hoddle Street, 5th floor and 11th floor, Noon Street, Clifton Hill, George Street, Fitzroy. Yeah, I've moved around a bit throughout Collingwood and Fitzroy, and it's not the same place as it used to be. I certainly couldn't afford to buy in Fitzroy and Collingwood these days, but, you know, it was where the struggle was, and it's where our people were, and we always looked after one another. No one was ever left out high and dry without a roof over their head or a feed in their belly. So that's what community is about. That's what our people have always been about. And if we can only get the rest of this country to start thinking and acting like we always have, then we should have a, you know, more caring, united country. And these are the real life stories that people need to hear, because they live in their privileged bubble and they don't come out of it.
Yeah, agreed. Look, you've come such a long way, Lydia. And I wanted to let you know something too, that Stephen Thorpe has organised, I think yesterday was the second Sunday lunch. We've got a true self-determining event happening every Sunday, and we're going to invite you next few weeks or whenever's available, whenever works for you on a Sunday, to come down and, you know, have lunch with us. And, you know, and come and hang with the mob. I actually recorded a heap of messages yesterday of support and congratulations. I didn't have time to get it prepared for this morning, unfortunately. But you do have lots of support, and we'd love to have you down there for lunch on a Sunday.
Deadly.
Whenever you've got a couple hours.
Yep, I'd love to do that. I missed, when I was in the Victorian Parliament, I'd always stop in Smith Street on payday and go and see my mob.
Oh, it's so different now.
But now I'm in Canberra, where I don't get the same opportunity to go down that path. But, yeah, I want to reconnect with our mob there.
Well, can't wait to see you there, but, you know, your time is almost up. I want to ask you about the Uluru statement, which is a hot topic at the minute. People in social media are saying that the Greens have backflipped, but is that entirely true? Can you give us, from your perspective as a position holder of Aboriginal Affairs portfolio for First Nations, can you tell us a little bit about the position of the Greens and how you got there, and what the vision is from the Greens in this space?
Absolutely. Look, the Greens have always supported the Uluru Statement, but the sequence is very different. And the sequence that we're putting forward is Treaty Truth and Voice, or Truth Treaty and Voice. So we need this country to come to terms with the true history of this country. We need to go down a path of truth-telling so people can get on board with a treaty or a voice if they want a voice over treaty. But we need to have a genuine consultation process, which I don't believe the Uluru Statement has done, and I'm not just saying that as me, it's just what I'm hearing around the country from grassroots blackfellas. And within the Greens, we have a First Nations caucus. So in every state and territory, we have what we call Black Greens, and they are Aboriginal members of the Greens Party who inform policy affecting First Nations people. So this is from their directive as well. They'll be taking some changes to the November National Greens Conference to basically solidify our position. But it is Truth, Treaty and Voice, and it's, you know, we're the only Commonwealth country in the world that doesn't have a treaty with its first people. A voice is a great idea, but it shouldn't be the priority. The priority should be that we have a treaty in this country, and we could then negotiate seats in Parliament rather than a voice to Parliament. And, you know, you can look at the Waitangi Treaty where they've got seats in Parliament there and, you know, some Truth and Reconciliation commissions such as the one in South Africa. So there's some things that we can do before we get to going into the Constitution so that everybody's absolutely clear about what that means for Aboriginal people to go into the colonial project constitution when we've maintained our right not to be included in that constitution thus far. So treaty is the priority. It's unfinished business, and every clan and nation should have the right to self-determine their own destiny and what their priorities and needs are through a genuine treaty dialogue.
I agree that treaty is absolutely got to be in there somewhere, but we've got to get some genocide, international, peremptory, normal laws around human rights engaged in this country too. We were discussing earlier about the Senator Brian Greig from 1999, who has this genocide bill still sort of pending. Hopefully that, you know, becomes, we just need a real law, some international scrutiny over the human rights, you know, abuses in the country.
Yeah, we heard from Uncle Rob before you came on about that, the genocide, what is it called? The motion.
Convention.
But no, there was a motion put forward in the 90s.
1999.
Through a senator from WA. And it'll be good to even, I don't know what the Greens think about that, but that seems really interesting old information.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to the Uluru Statement. They say that there's consensus from over 100 Indigenous people at a national gathering. 250 delegates adopted the Uluru Statement. And I think it's really funny because actually the three of us were there. And it's just, I mean, there was a walkout and they say that the walkout were just a small few from Victoria, but actually there was a walkout from Dubbo and some people from Hobart actually and Sydney and most definitely Melbourne. I think all but one walked out from Melbourne. So for me, I just think that that protocol, that initial protocol wasn't followed. So I'm interested to see how you might do things differently in that space, Lydia.
Well, it can't be exclusive. And that's what I've heard and saw with my own eyes, that the Uluru dialogues were invite only. So a lot of grassroots voices were denied access to these meetings. I went to the Sydney and Melbourne dialogue, and in Sydney people were denied access. In fact, an elder was locked up and thrown in the back of a divvy wagon because he was protesting outside, and that was just a horrible, horrible sight. He lit a fire and the fire brigade come and put it out. It was just overkill. But, you know, that was one ugly scene from one of the dialogues that we don't hear about. There was dissenting voices at the Victorian dialogue. They hadn't even thought about doing an ACT dialogue until people really, you know, played up and said that they wanted to have one there. So it cannot be an exclusive conversation. It's got to be open to all clans and nations on country so that they can self-determine. They need to have information prior so that they know what we're talking about, the pros and cons for each area that we want to discuss. Because, again, even with the Uluru Statement or that, particularly that meeting in Uluru, there was no free, prior and informed consent. There were people who didn't have interpreters whose English was third or fourth language. So, you know, let's be real here and not exclude people and make sure that people are resourced to get to a meeting. We know at the end of the day, you know, government particularly push short time frames and tight time frames. That's a strategy to exclude people. So we need to make sure people can get in a car or a bus or a train or whatever to get to a meeting and have their say, because, you know, there's a lot of unhappy people around who went to that meeting and they're not even getting a platform to speak about their experiences. And I'm working on that. in terms of, you know, let's really talk about what happened at Uluru and let's get those voices out there.
Yeah, shame job, you know, from behalf of those fellas. It really was.
It was awful.
I was a witness to that too. It was, and, you know, that what they're trying to put out that it was is just lies, yeah.
Yeah, I think they're saying, like, only 9 people walked out, but I counted, I can't remember the number, but it's just tell the truth. Be honest, you know.
Where's Uncle Les Coe from? He's gone now, but he's recording. He was definitely dissent.
Good to play that after. But he was from Dubbo, I think.
Dubbo.
He would have been around Dubbo or Sydney. And his daughter was there too. But, and I can't wait for the truth about the National Convention to come out. And I know that a lot of people were really hurt by the campaign ran against the walkouts as well and some of the tactics that were used against us. And, you know, even the lies that were perpetuated, I'm really shocked. And so I'm really hopeful that only the truth can come out from that, and we'll wait and see. It's still there.
Yeah. And can I just add that the latest campaign and why they're coming out hard now is because they've just received some new funding to run a new campaign for the Uluru Statement, and that's funded by the BHP Foundation.
Wow. Well, you know, it's a David and Goliath fight, and I think that as long as we keep our voices alive through independent radio, we don't, you know, this is grassroots voice, that we've got to keep it up and keep going. All right, Lydia?
That's right. And look, if grassroots people want to voice the parliament and they want to go into the constitution and be recognised by the colonisers, absolutely, I will stand by them 100%. But our grassroots mob have not had the opportunity to have a say or get informed. And until such time, I can't agree to something that our mob haven't even had a discussion about.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that and taking up this very, this role, because we need someone to tell them and make sure they're here that, yeah, this is a fact.
Yeah, because my experience in community does not reflect what they're saying.
Same.
And I am from this community, you know, and if there's others from there and if there's other black followers saying it, then, like, let's have the conversation. Let's hear it. But I just think the truth has to be told too. Not just trinkets and pretty campaigns by, you know, backed by millions of dollars.
That's right. And we don't need to tear each other down in the media either. We're all blackfellas at the end of the day, and we might have differences of opinion, but it doesn't mean we destroy each other because of our difference of opinion. Let's have a respectful debate, like our old people always have, and have these yarns rather than call each other out in the media.
Mm. Yep. Agreed. Lydia, thank you so much for your time on Black Bloc 3CR today.
Thanks, Lydia.
My pleasure.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.